It's the Wonky Show. Student loans have been all over the news. Does anyone in government have a plan? UKRI seems to have a comms crisis as curiosity-driven research funding hangs in the balance. And we're off to Wales to find out about the big five challenges facing tertiary. It's all coming up.
You only have to look at the experience of places that don't have them to see how expensive it is not to have them as well. So we need to start this conversation with, at its heart, what a sustainable system that benefits people and delivers what it needs to deliver to as many people as possible is, not from how do we tweak terms and conditions of loan repayments.
Welcome back to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm your host, Jim Dickinson, and here to help us work out who's going to blink first, as usual, three excellent guests. On the world-famous Oxford Road, Ben Ward is CEO at University of Manchester Students' Union. Ben, your highlight of the week, please.
Well, we're back in semester two and the campus has come alive again. And I have to say, just walking around our refreshers fair, it really does re-energise. No matter how long I do this, just seeing people finding that thing that that will transform their university experience is really nourishing.
What's your favourite new society this year, Ben?
Well, with the skydiving one is back actually, which I'm sure I'm going to see more paperwork about.
In Birmingham this week, Smita Jamdar is partner and head of education at Shakespeare Martineau. Smita, your highlight of the week, please.
Jim, so far this week, I've done very little apart from deal with some quite difficult cases. So could I take a privilege and talk about my highlight of last week, which was attending a conference organised by the College Alliance, which was looking at how we get NEETs and adults who are excluded from education back into education and hopefully onto higher education. And it was one of the most interesting, potentially inspiring conferences, you know, if we can deliver what we could deliver that I've been to. So it was fantastic.
Excellent stuff. And in Oxford this week, Michael Salmon is news editor at Wonky. Michael, your highlight of the week, please.
I did rack my brains, but I am ill. The weather's terrible. I keep having one bad night's sleep after another. So I'm going to just have to pin my hopes for a highlight on our Wonky team meeting tomorrow, which controversially is being held on a Friday in London. But let's hope that proves a highlight.
On a Friday? When did we decide this and why?
Don't know.
Anyway, right. So yes, we start this week with student finance. Student loans, debt, all of that stuff has suddenly caught light in the news, Michael.
Yeah, well, suddenly is one way of putting it. I mean, a not insignificant part of my job is keeping an eye on and sort of trying to read between the lines of what's going on in the mainstream press, you know, and it's spicy out there at the moment for, HE student finance. It has really been all of January. You know, there's been one story after another, kind of provoked by this sort of slow burn of unhappiness about the changes in the budgets, freezing the student loan repayment thresholds for Plan 2 borrowers in England. The last week has been, you know, up to fever pitch. You know, The Observer did a big story about, you know, the backbench Labour MPs that are pushing the government to do something. The Sunday Times commissioned some polling that, you know, found, to the surprise of probably very few, that people really hate this idea of interest rates. And even, you know, some quite a lot of Labour and Green voters are pretty keen on student loan write-offs. Rachel Reeves has been forced to defend, you know, the system a couple of times, which is, you know, always an indication that a story is cutting through when, you know, the Chancellor starts getting asked about it a lot. You know, Wes Streeting has popped up, you know, after, you know, ex-NUS Prez Wes Streeting, after about, you know, a decade of silence on anything to do with higher education, has suddenly said, oh yeah, we need a national conversation. Over in Wales, the government has made a very interesting announcement about not following England's move, which I'm sure we'll talk about. You know, there's loads and loads going on. And the question is, you know, does it get to a point where the government is sort of bounced into action? I mean, you know, obviously at the moment they have their hands full with, you know, much bigger things, but it does really seem to be building to a head at the moment.
Yes, fascinating. Now, there's been no end of coverage of this. Let's get a flavour of it from Elliot, a caller to Sheila Fogarty's show on LBC.
Elliot has called from Bournemouth. Hi, Elliot.
Hi, Wes. Hi, Sheila. Thanks for having me on. Anyway, I'm a nurse in a dementia nursing home. I graduated in 2023. And I have £105,000 of student debt. Now, I'd need to be earning £90,000 a year just to break even on the current interest rates I'm being charged. That's not paying any of the principal. That's because I dropped out of my final year to help with the pandemic response and had to fund a retake of that year. Less than a week ago, the Chancellor said the status quo with student loans is fair and reasonable. Now, I'd just like to ask you a straightforward question, Wes. Do you agree with Rachel Reeves that this level of student debt is fair and reasonable for me and my colleagues in healthcare?
You are calling to my past as a former president of the National Union of Students, and I have not forgotten my roots and the things that I campaigned on back then. I do think it's fair to ask graduates to make a financial contribution to not just our own university education, but widening access and opportunities to universities. Because when it used to be the case that everyone's fees were funded and they got maintenance grants for everyone, a very small and often privileged group of people got to go to university and the rest were left behind. And so in order to expand access to universities, graduates were asked to make a contribution. Now, in all of the systems that we've seen to charge students or indeed graduates, I don't think any of them have got it right. So the upfront fees that Labour introduced after 1997 were a real problem. Then they moved it to graduate repayments. I thought, well, that will be better. But then the fees were whacked up to 3,000. But then the coalition came in and they trebled them to 9 grand, and then people left with these eye-watering levels of debt. And while the debt is written off after, I think it's 30 odd years, isn't it? The debt gets written off. I appreciate that for you, Elliot, that is not a very inspiring message. And that when you get your statements through from the student finance, it is very demoralizing when you see that your repayments are going in, but the interest being charged is even higher.
It's a combination of things for people, isn't it? It's the sort of Damocles figure hanging over them. But it's also, and Rachel Reeves was quick to say it's fair because you only pay if you can afford it. Even if you can afford it, it's still having an impact on the money you make as a young
person. Well, in the context of cost of living, I am uncomfortable about the marginal tax rate that graduates. I have. And now I feel, to be honest, I feel like one of you lot now from your generation who had free education.
All right.
Because, you know, when you go to university, you know, when my generation, we used to sit there and listen to your generation. Oh, of course, we had it all grant in our days. And it's like, oh, bully for you. And now I feel like one of the bully for you people because my student loan is paid off. And I did notice, by the way, every time I got my payslip, you notice the deductions. So the long and short of it is, I do think we need to look in the round of all of this. I think there's a debate for us to have as a country about what our priorities are. And there are all sorts of things you could do with student finance, for example. You could say, well, the interest rate is too high. Or you could say that the repayment threshold is too low. Or you could say that the amount that's taken each month is too high. There are lots of variables. They all, by the way, come with costs.
Well, Ben, this is fascinating, isn't it? Because that exchange really highlights the big problem, which is there is a big subsidy in that scheme. But for Elliot, what Elliot can see is this massive debt load in the bottom right-hand corner of his student loan statement.
Yeah, I mean, look, no one is happy about this system. You know, we see both sides of the equation now suffering. Universities are, you know, suffering financially. Students are suffering financially. And it feels like we're approaching a sort of a Deering or Brown moment for dealing with the powder keg that is the university finance system. You know, that there is a huge, you know, time bomb on the student loan system that we've always known about right from its creation. And it probably gets even worse for those who are studying post 2023, where the repayment thresholds, you know, are removed, the write-off window is extended. So, you know, this is something that is, in your words, a wicked problem that really needs looking at.
Yeah, I mean, there's all sorts in here, isn't there, Samita? I mean, that graduate, who is presumably the sort of graduate that Wes might expect would vote for the government and would vote for the government again. That graduate, it sounds really, really angry. And to some extent, given their circumstances, you can see why.
Oh, I mean, 100%. If you listen to that call, it's so powerful, isn't it? To say, I've got debt of £105,000 to study, to do a job that society desperately needs me to do, and which isn't never going to be, you know, phenomenally well paid. So I think it is a really difficult situation for government that, you know, many of the people that would be expected to vote for them are going to be precisely in this situation. For me, I think one of the problems is just looking at this very narrowly isn't going to help. As Ben said, the problem now is we've got a system that works for no one. It doesn't work for the individual. It doesn't work for universities, and it doesn't work for taxpayers, because they are funding something, but they're not funding it necessarily in the most constructive way. And I just think, I know it always feels like a default just to say we do need to look at it all again, but I can't see a way out of it without some hard questions about what is education for? I really don't like the idea of the only people who benefit from higher education are those who directly study in it. We all benefit from a skilled workforce and from people who can do fantastic things like surgery or building bridges or whatever it is. So we really do need to start asking some questions, but where is the time or the mechanism to do any of that rather than just tweaking what is really not a satisfactory system?
One of the things that I think is really interesting in that call, Michael, is when Wes says it is right that students or graduates make a contribution, he doesn't say, well, you know, I mean, there's a world of difference between making a 10% contribution and a 95% contribution, for example. And that's part of the problem, isn't it?
Yeah, it completely is. I mean, I think that's why, you know, we get these sort of stories bubbling up every now and then, sort of campaigns, petitions, you know, but the move at the budget, as it sort of slowly kind of dawned and filtered through into sort of, you know, the popular consciousness of those graduates affected by it, you know, I think it's sort of those who graduated between 2012 and 2022, you know, quite how bad this is going to be, quite how, you know, out of order they find the idea of changing the terms and conditions. You know, that's essentially what how people are saying it, changing, you know, the target amount they need to hit by sort of, you know, by fiddling around with both thresholds and interest rates in a way that was sort of never quite been explained clearly. Yeah, it's really unsurprising that it has become a big issue this time. And these kind of government lines on it, like, well, you know, we expect everyone to make a contribution, is, you know, not cutting through at all, because it's, as you say, it's about, you know, is it a small contribution, a reasonable contribution, or is it one that just, you know, feels deeply unfair?
One of the sort of features in the Gordian knot, Ben, is that, of course, that graduate on plan two with £100,000 worth of debt is over their lifetime going to pay exactly the same as someone with a much lower level of debt, because almost all of them are just going to pay the graduate tax for 30 years. But it doesn't seem like there's a way to explain that in a way that makes sense to people. And that's partly because we use the language of fees and debt, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the sticker price has always been the difficult thing. You know, when we were having the debates in 2010 about, you know, graduate tax versus fees, that was always the, you know, there were, you know, universities wanted something linked to a price. But, you know, in reality, it lasts for 30 years from the new plan, 40 years. But, you know, the recent decision to freeze the repayment threshold, you know, the lowest earners will be paying something like an extra £5,000 over the life of the loan repayment period. So there is no way, you know, we talk about, don't let this put you off going to university. It's not a debt, it's a tax. But of course, it is a debt when you're trying to balance it with other things that you're trying to achieve in your life, whether that's getting on the property ladder, starting a family, you know, all of the rest of it that, you know, has been promised.
I mean, part of the argument, I think, Smeeter, is that you can make it feel more like a progressive tax. And in those circumstances, what you wouldn't do is, for someone in Elliot's situation, you wouldn't charge them an extra year, right? But then on the other hand, you know, we're about to hurtle our way into a lifelong learning entitlement. And that the whole point of that is that for the gobbets of learning that you undertake, you accrue debt based on that, you know, stuff that level of credit that you have taken on. Now, you can't really combine those two concepts without upsetting everyone, can you?
Well, absolutely. There seems to me to be, as we've known for a long time with the lifelong learning entitlement, how it sits alongside the existing systems we've got, the existing expectations that students have about how the funding works, what they'll pay, even taking into account that that's changed over time. None of this really hangs together terribly well. And that, I think, was presumably what Wes Streeting was talking about when he was suggesting that we do need to have another look at the whole thing. But there isn't a coherence here. There isn't a really clear message you can give young people. I'm always struck by the fact that universities rightly are expected to focus on the provision of clear information, etc. But how many of the people who took these loans really understood at the time what the implications could be for them and what changes could be made over the lifetime? And it doesn't exactly inspire confidence in other people to say, yes, I will take on this debt because I know exactly what it's going to mean for me in, you know, 5-10 years time. It's really not a very useful system for helping people make those long-term decisions.
No, and I think that's Martin Lewis's point as well. You know, obviously it's cut through so far that, you know, the money-saving expert is all over.
Money-saving expert, yep. Alarm has gone off.
Yeah, I mean, he's been very consistent on this for a long time, but, you know, he's spoken in the last week about, you know, how immoral it is to be changing the terms of things that were poorly understood in the first place. And, you know, government would quite rightly regulate credit companies from doing this kind of retrospective changes to terms and conditions.
When Martin Lewis breaks the fourth wall on Newsnight, stares into the camera, you know you've got a problem, don't you? But Michael, I guess one of the questions is, you know, why was this slipped into the budget? You know, what is going on? We don't really know what's going on in the Treasury, do we? Was this just a sort of late night way to make Rachel Reeves' numbers add up? Or is, you know, something else going on in terms of the overall sustainability of the system?
I mean, I think longer term, we do have indications that, you know, the government is concerned about the overall cost to the Treasury, to the sort of the country's bottom line of managing the student loan system, and is looking for ways to squeeze additional bits of funding out of it. I mean, I think there was a sort of short term, if you remember all the sort of, you know, OBR related crises that preceded the budget and, you know, lots of leadership speculation that, you know, there was an immediate need to find some money. There was a note in the Office for Budget Responsibilities sort of paperwork on the budget that they said, you know, changes to the student loan repayment threshold were being made even sort of right up to the wire. So there was clearly quite a live issue, and, you know, an extent to which it was sort of thrown together. I really don't know whether there was any planning for the sort of political fallout from it, or how much DfE were involved in these decisions, because, you know, obviously now they become front and center with dealing with the response of it. Yeah, it is a little bit of a mystery, especially given what Labour said in opposition, as you know, a point that you have been hammering home all the way through 2026 so far. You know, they said graduates will pay less each week. Essentially, what they've done with this move is they've extended the amounts that those people who are able to pay off their Plan 2 student loan will now be paying it off for a little bit longer.
All I was going to say on Wes is, obviously, you know, whilst, you know, he has form on this as a former president of NUS, he's got his own challenges with the NHS workforce plan. And, you know, there is a dementia nurse on there talking about this level of debt. How on earth is he going to incentivize and persuade people to go into those professions?
Yes, because there's that really weird, uneasy sort of relationship between DfE's funding and then that sort of top up that exists in the health service, isn't there, for their costs. But of course, the other thing, Benny, is presumably he's got his eye on, I mean, notwithstanding, you know, all the other political chaos this week, he must have his eye on, you know, attempting to be to replace Starmer.
Well, I mean, I don't know when this podcast is going out, but, you know, that may well have happened by the time that it does. Yes, I mean, I think, you know, there's clear political manoeuvrings going on in a whole range of things. You know, he's remained relatively silent on the issue of student finance, you know, so as not to be pigeonholed. But, you know, this has a huge bleed across into what's happening with the NHS. You know, an interesting, you know, he puts the dichotomy in that interview on LBC between, you know, Rachel Reeves putting more money into getting waiting lists down or money into this system. But, you know, the two are intrinsically linked.
Smita, from a sort of wider point of view, this idea, aspirational graduates graduate into a repayment threshold that's much lower than perhaps morally they were ever promised. I guess the Martin Lewis point. A really challenging graduate labour market and lots of other fiscal drag in the other parts of the tax system, kind of dragging them down too. Is it just, you know, whiny, you know, young millennials or, you know, whichever generation we're talking about? Is this just whining people that suddenly find themselves in journalism jobs? Or is there a real face here around, you know, the kind of plight of the young?
Oh, I 100% think there's a real case here for the plight of the young. And the conference that I talked about at the beginning, I suppose, was talking about a very different demographic of young people and even adults, but who are still young-ish adults, much younger than me. And There are a couple of points made there, which I think are really important. The first is it's absolutely clear that the brunt of austerity has been borne by the young. So this generation, you know, that coming through, they've grown up with lots and lots of cuts, very limited services. They haven't seen the benefits of a tax system that looked after them. And yet they're being repeatedly told that it's right and proper that they should pay for what they've got. But nobody has supported them. I think that's there's something psychological about that. And the other thing, I suppose, is they've grown up in a time of polycrises. They just lurch from one thing to another, you know, the global financial crisis into COVID, into, you know, the collapse of the rules-based international order. All these things take their toll. And we need to look after our young people an awful lot better, just so that, you know, those approaching pension age like me have somebody actually willing to work and contribute to public finances in the future. Leave aside all the sort of democratic issues around, you know, the disengagement these people, young people feel with the system that has let them down. I find it astonishing that they're presented as entitled in any way. There is a generation of people who've grown up benefiting from a really strong public sector, and it's not them.
Now, Michael, we've got a new colleague, have we not, who's added his voice to the debate.
Yeah, it's been a big week in the sort of extended wonky cinematic universe with our sort of affiliated think tank, the Post 18 Project, which we launched last spring, has now got its first proper director, and it's John Blake, the former Access and Participation Director at the OFS, who left at the end of last year, and he's now popped up in the Times and on the Post 18 Project website saying that, you know, the system is doomed, in his opinion, which is a nice sort of eye-catching beginning to his tenure. And, you know, he's really sort of thinking about it from, in I think, political terms and in sort of reputational terms, you know, as opposed to getting into the sort of weeds of, you know, plan two, plan five, repayment threshold, you know, this sort of, you know, the sort of policy wonk conversation. He's more saying, you know, the social contract between, you know, the higher education system and the population has been broken by this system. And, you know, a review of some kind of either of student finance or, you know, ideally of higher education funding more widely is inevitable, needs to happen. The government needs to decide, does it want to just be bounced into it, or does it want to, you know, start thinking about planning for this?
Many students who graduated after 2012 left with tens of thousands of pounds of debt. We've been talking about a lot on this on Times Radio Breakfast. They're now paying interest rates well above inflation, which means lots of them are seeing the amount they owe going up and up rather than going down. It seems likely many of them will never pay back the money before the debt is written off after whatever it is, 25 years, then maybe 40 years. All of this has led to one former higher education regulator to tell the Times the system is doomed and should be replaced by a graduate tax. He is Professor John Blake, now director of the Post 18 Project think tank, and until last month was director of Fair Access at the Office for Students. John joins us now. Morning to you.
Morning.
A lot of people regard the student loan system as a graduate tax already. How would terming it a graduate tax make a difference?
Well, I think the fundamental problem is that, yes, it functions as a graduate tax for most students, but not for all students. So not for students whose parents are wealthy enough to ensure that they never need to take the loans out in the first place, not for graduates who entered the system before this system was used. So if it is in fact functioning a graduate tax, then why don't we just create a proper graduate tax? Yeah. You know, and I think that's part of the problem is that the way it's being experienced and the way it's set up just feels fundamentally unfair because it treats people very differently. And it has, you know, ticking up in the corner of that student loans company letter they get every year, a number that just gets higher and higher and higher. And the fact that they're, you know, ultimately never going to pay it off isn't as comforting as people thought it might have been when the system was set up.
Yeah, I remember when I was a student, around the time it was set up, I was told it's the best loan you'll ever be able to take. And of course, that has not turned out to be the case.
Well, I mean, ironically, in a sense it is, but no high street bank has ever replicated the student loans company offer. But that just isn't how it feels. And I think fundamentally, public policy has to be for the public. If it's the case that something works at a sort of works on a spreadsheet and, it, you know, people are like, well, they should feel this is really generous. Maybe they should, but they clearly don't. And I think that's a real problem.
I'll tell you what, Ben, right? One of the things, you know, I mean, clearly, there might, you know, maybe we'll get a review. And of course, to some extent, what a review will probably do is address things for, you know, a future cohort or a future set of cohorts. But one of the issues, I guess, you know, where I'd got to a couple of weeks ago was, if you try and do something for existing loan holders, there's always a kind of financial implication. And if the government is spending money on that, what it's not doing is spending money on current students or current universities.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, look, there are 2.3 million angry people now on the Plan 2 system from 2012 to 2023. And they are going to, you know, exist in the system, paying taxes, voting for, you know, the next 30 to 40 years. So, you know, that will be a time bomb for whoever is in government. But every pound, you're right, you spend on them isn't a pound being spent on current students and university or tertiary education. And that is a trade-off.
And then, Michael, we've also, because one of the floating questions that's been kind of floating, is Wales going to do what England has announced it will do on Plan 2? Because we share Plan 2 with Wales. What's going on there?
Yeah, I remember on the day of the budget, we were all, you know, sort of looking through the documents, spotted this thing, thinking, whoa, this is, you know, what does this mean for, you know, those that sort of decade worth of English repayers? And then at some point, and it was about, you know, 8:30 p.m., one of us was like, wait, hang on, what about Wales? You know, they're still on Plan 2. It's like they refuse to follow England into the Plan 5 system, which has lower interest rates, but has 40 years worth of repayments. This, you know, they saw it as a regressive move. And, you know, then this question began to sort of swirl about, you know, had they told Wales about that? Can, you know, technically Welsh ministers need to give their okay for this? It's not that England decides for Wales on this aspect of repayment. And yeah, we had the announcement at First Minister's questions in the Senedd. Eluned Morgan, you know, in kind of no uncertain terms, said, we've decided we're not following England down this route. Obviously, they have an election coming up very soon, and it's not just the local elections, it's the proper, you know, national Welsh elections. And they also have this sort of review going on. So, and they've, you know, the higher education minister said to me this week that, you know, they don't want to preempt what that's going to find. But yeah, it's still quite a shock, and it's going to have some pretty big consequences for, you know, how the Welsh system fits into the kind of envelope that the Treasury gives it.
Yeah, let's hear what the First Minister had to say.
Only the Welsh Labour government ministers can set the repayment threshold for Welsh borrowers. The UK government can't determine the threshold for Welsh students, and any change requires a decision by the Welsh government. And I want to make it clear today that we have no intention of freezing the thresholds and following England in this regard. We'll work with the UK government to understand the full implications of the change. We need a proper impact assessment, and that's clearly where we stand.
She hadn't even been asked about it. It was like she got some notes ready to ask about it. She thought, I may as well defend it without being attacked. I mean, look, Smita, this just underlines the problem, doesn't it? This is very important politically, but my God, is this complicated to fix. And once you get out into devolution land, I mean, blimey.
Oh, 100%. And I think the point you made earlier in this conversation was we end up with different people having very different experiences in a system, you know, where they're essentially in the same category as the other people who are in some other, you know, position. So it is becoming hugely complicated, and all of that will have different electoral impacts. I mean, who even knows, you know, what the political position in Wales is going to be in a few months' time, and what the position around tuition fees will be there. I mean, I dread to bring them up, because it's not about Wales particularly, but Reform, for example, have put forward their own proposals around student loans. So we do have this is a political question now, as well as a financial one and as well as a fairness one. And the risk is that we will end up in a relatively, you know, small country with numerous different systems that will add to the confusion as to, you know, trying to get people to understand the system. And, you know, it isn't easy to understand now. It will be even worse once we have divergent systems going on across the graduate cohorts and across the country.
I mean, one of the really interesting things, Ben, is that, you know, we sort of know from various budget documents and from the auditor's report, actually, in Wales and Scotland, that new modelling from DfE indicates that the repayments that they thought that graduates were going to be making are not hitting those numbers. You know, that's either something going on in the wider economy, or it's making loans to people whose courses just aren't delivering the returns and so on. And I guess on the one hand, you've got, you know, potentially a Treasury and a government saying, look, you know, we need more of this money paid back. And then on the other hand, you've got the Martin Lewis position, which is, hold on, you can't just change the terms after people have made the loan 10 years later. That is how on earth do you resolve that?
Well, it's an unresolvable thing, isn't it? You know, because it points in so many different things. It points to, you know, a sudden drop in graduate recruitment, you know, due to employee costs, the rise of AI, all sorts of complicated things that, you know, that is impinging on it. But it just feels to me, as I said at the very start of this, we're approaching the political and economic climate where we were in the lead up to the Deering Review, the Brown Review, you know, universities saying that they're in bits, graduates saying that they're, you know, they can't take much more of this. So, you know, I think John Blake is right to say that the whole thing needs reinventing.
You know, the risk we run in having that conversation, or a necessary conversation though it is that the answer will be, well, we can't afford universities anymore. And if you look, or fewer of them, absolutely. If we think it's expensive to have universities, you only have to look at the experience of places that don't have them to see how expensive it is not to have them as well. So we need to start this conversation with at its heart what a sustainable system that benefits people and delivers what it needs to deliver to as many people as possible is, not from how do we tweak terms and conditions of loan repayments. That's the wrong place, in my view, to start this conversation.
Right now, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hi, I'm Sean Jackson, an employment partner at Mills & Reeve, specialising in the sector. After months of parliamentary back and forth, the Employment Rights Act 2025 finally made it into the statute books just before Christmas, with wide-ranging implications for the sector. From new rules on unfair dismissal and zero-hours contracts, to tougher requirements on sexual harassment and major changes to industrial action. These reforms will have a real impact on how universities manage their people and risk. In my blog, I've set out 5 things that sector leaders need to know to prepare for these reforms, with a handy table of implementation dates.
Now, next up, research funding. A messy week for UKRI, Ben.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, you could argue it was a perfect comm storm, but actually, you know, it's just a follow-on from, you know, previous announcements in how they will approach research funding over the coming few years. So lots of speculation on curiosity-driven or fundamental science research, but it's set against the background of UKRI having radically changed its budget allocations for the upcoming years. So unsurprisingly, lots of focus on industrial strategy areas, much less clarity about the individual research councils.
Well, Jim, I had some thoughts about a more interesting aspect to this, but it's not very interesting, it has to be said. But it struck me that this was it demonstrates a number of different things. First of all, how hard it is to communicate quite complicated changes in a way that can't then be either deliberately or inadvertently misunderstood and represented as something they're not. Because I think UKRI's explanation, as Ben said, is this is a development of something we'd already announced. And the second thing is, we can all get people to accept in the abstract that there is limited money and we have to make decisions and we have to do strategic things rather than just what we've always done. But as soon as it affects something that people care about, then suddenly it ceases to be strategic. So it appears to be that it's to do with particular challenges around the financing of one research council rather than a general, you know, issue. But because this is a research council that is seen as important by many, that's not where we make the cuts. And I know we shouldn't keep going back to the conversation we've just had about student loans. This is the challenge facing government. We need to do more with less, but nobody agrees on what the less should be, you know, where the less should happen. It's kind of that this is a communications problem, which UKRI need to get a handle on, rather than a substantive problem. There is a substantive issue, but it's not caused by the thing that people are angry about.
Yes, this idea that it might be a comms problem more than anything else was something raised in Parliament. Here's a clip.
So we made some decisions about really being deliberate in our choice, and
the right thing that to do, and indeed what we planned to do, was to then talk about those decisions to stakeholders, to those affected, go blow by blow and bring people on the journey of why we'd made those choices before we then communicated to the outside world. We were not able to do that because of information leaks outside the organization. And so we ended up having to rush comms out when we hadn't done that engagement, for which I am very sorry. I realize that this causes upset, it causes uncertainty, it causes people to actually worry about their jobs, quite fundamental.
Yeah, so, you know, that was Ian Chapman sort of trying to kind of say that it was, you know, there was a plan in place, but things had to be rushed out. I mean, I should also say it wasn't just one research council. So there was the Sciences and Technology, the STFC has, you know, it was announced they're seeking, you know, some quite big cuts due to...
Yeah, that was like a 30% reduction that they'd been asked to model, right?
Yeah, I think they've overspent a lot, you know, things like international subscriptions, energy costs have gone up more than they expected. From what he said to the committee, it sounded like, you know, previous planning had been quite optimistic about how much the government was going to give to UKRI. You know, but there's been other, I think, three or possibly four other research councils have, you know, temporarily paused grants. You know, they've said, you know, this program, mysterious messages appearing on the website saying, hang on, don't apply yet, more news soon. And, you know, so that load and load of speculation started to build up among researchers. Ian Chapman had to write an open letter. It came out at sort of Sunday tea time, which is always a bad sign. I mean, I think the whole story speaks to worries in lots of UK universities and elsewhere in UK research that curiosity-driven research is no longer such a priority. UKRI's line is like, oh, well, you know, look at this bucket. We've got this big bucket that we call curiosity-driven research, and we're going to keep spending lots on it. You know, it's debatable how much that is true because they've essentially put all of QR funding in that bucket. I think, you know, larger scale, it speaks to, you know, I think UKRI has become very good under Ian Chapman and with Patrick Collins as minister of doing this sort of macro, you know, vision for UK research, which accords with the government's priorities and is sort of, you know, this whole picking winners, focusing on our strengths things. How does that translate, kind of as Smita was saying before, how does that translate down to the level of individual researchers and research teams and specific disciplines? You know, it's okay to say, oh, you know, life sciences is part of the, you know, industrial strategy. But if I'm in a, you know, a research center or a team that works in one specific area, what I'm interested in is knowing, you know, where's the continuity of grants? Are things that I was planning to apply for being cancelled? You know, what does it mean for me and my career? And, you know, that's a real challenge in terms of communications, but also in terms of actually, you know, operations.
Yes, because it's not just like there's one funding body sat between me and government. There's the actual research councils as well as UKRI, isn't there? And I guess by the time it filters all the way through, there are lots of opportunities for people to get very both, you know, perhaps justifiably paranoid and upset, Ben.
Yeah, absolutely. There's so many different cooks involved in this. I mean, interestingly, that you know, the headline grabbing things, particularly around fundamental science, around our work at CERN. So the UK continuing to fund CERN central costs, for instance, but actually money for individual UK projects in the Large Hadron Collider and probably going to be cutting. And so, you know, this presents a really complex ecosystem. But if we go back to the state of university finances, you know, most universities are already losing money on this work anyway, and further uncertainty into the system isn't helpful.
Now, one of the things that's been happening this week is the judicial review into the decision from the Office for Students to fine the University of Sussex over free speech. David Kernahan from the team has been reading the briefs.
Hi, so this is DK here. I've been keeping an eye on the judicial review of the Office for Students' decision to fine the University of Sussex £585,000 for alleged breaches of conditions of registration E1 and E2. This has been going on in the administrative bit of the High Court, and let me tell you, it's been absolutely fascinating to watch what is going on and the legal arguments that are being marshalled. There's two key articles on the site I'd urge you to keep an eye on, because the last thing you want in this podcast is me trying to explain points of law. There is an article that is based on the University of Sussex's skeleton argument that was up a few weeks back, and one on the Office for Students that I did during the trial itself, because I managed to get hold of the Office for Students skeleton argument. There's lots of stuff going on here that has got implications much wider than the actual decision itself. I did a note on Wonk Corner the other day about the role of the university visitor, which I think is really, really interesting, because the University of Sussex has a royal charter. It has a university visitor who is supposedly the exclusive authority on the way the university applies its own regulations and rules. Because one of the reasons that the Office for Students made the fine is because they didn't believe the university was following its own rules on delegation of authority. This becomes a point of contention. But the upshot could potentially mean that the Office for Students doesn't actually have the authority to regulate university with a royal charter in this way. This would obviously be a huge deal and a massive problem for the work that the Office for Students actually does. So that's been absolutely fascinating to hear argued. I'm really not sure which way that's going to land. I initially thought it wasn't going to be a big issue, but I'm becoming more and more convinced that it might be. We will be getting a written judgment. That'll be maybe 3 or 4 weeks' time. That will all be on Wonky as soon as we get it. But yeah, this has been absolutely fascinating stuff. I'm recording this before the start of day 3, so I'm looking forward to seeing what happens at the end of the Office for Students walking the judge through their skeleton argument, and then any final comments the judge might decide to make.
Now, there's a human here, or maybe not. See if you can guess. They're telling us about an event coming up in the new year. Hi, it's Jim from the team here. AI hasn't just changed how students write essays. It's forced us to confront what learning actually means. As The Secret Life of Students returns for its 8th year, we're launching major new research revealing how students are really using AI, discussing what Graduate Ready means in 2026, and showcasing institutions already reimagining assessment for authentic learning at scale. Taking a step beyond what has felt like, for many, a moment of crisis, we're looking at it as a chance for creativity and a chance to reimagine what higher education is actually for, to strip away assessments that measure memorization rather than meaning making, and to design learning experiences that develop capabilities no algorithm can replicate. At the event, you'll explore how AI can enhance rather than replace human learning, what that means for everyone, with a new government white paper reshaping the landscape from oracy initiatives to work-based learning at scale. The Secret Life of Students is the event you need. With institutions under pressure to demonstrate genuine learning gain, the timing couldn't be sharper. This is the essential gathering for anyone working on student experience, teaching practice, or education policy, where you'll get evidence, not platitudes, practical strategies, not theoretical debates, and a vision of higher education that's more human, not less. That's The Secret Life of Students, learning to be human in an age of AI, March 2026. Tickets are available now. Book on wonky.com/events. Now, finally this week, Michael, off of, you know, one of the guests this week, has sat down with Welsh Minister Vicky Howells to talk about, well, let's have a listen.
So I'm joined today by Vicky Howells, Minister for Further and Higher Education in the Welsh Government. Minister, thank you so much for coming on the Wonky Show this week. We're going to talk about the call for evidence that's been launched on the future of Wales's tertiary sector, but I hoped we could briefly start by addressing the First Minister's announcement yesterday, which, you know, for us at Wonky Towers was a pretty big deal, which was that the Welsh Government, she said, has no intention of following England with the threshold freeze on graduate loan repayments, which, you know, as we've seen, has been a real source of controversy in England. You know, what can you tell us at this point in time about the Welsh government's thinking?
So as the First Minister said yesterday, we've no intention of freezing thresholds for Welsh borrowers. Only Welsh government ministers can set the repayment threshold for Welsh borrowers, and any decision would be made by us in Welsh government. You know, we've been looking at this proposal, and we don't really feel that it's a good fit for us and with the values that underpin the diamond package. So we got no intention to freeze the threshold here in Wales. We are working with the UK government to understand the financial and operational implications of our decision. But, you know, you'll be aware as well that we just launched this paper and this call for evidence on the whole future of the tertiary system here in Wales. And a large part of that is about financial sustainability. So we don't want to preempt that call for evidence by taking any decision now. And it's certainly not a decision that this Welsh Labour government would take.
As you've mentioned, you know, this call for evidence that's recently opened, you know, so is thinking about the whole of the future of the, you know, tertiary system in Wales ahead of the elections. Perhaps you could just sort of briefly talk our listeners through what it is and also maybe why you've decided to go down this route.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm really proud that we're the first administration anywhere in the UK to launch such a large and comprehensive call for evidence. And I wanted it to be honest and really candid about the challenges facing the sector. So we've set out five challenges which we're asking people to give submissions on. And we feel that they are the five core problems facing not just here in Wales, but across the UK as well. So we're focusing on participation and equality of opportunity, ensuring that everyone, regardless of their background, can access and succeed in further and higher education. We're focusing on that huge issue of demographic change, the substantial drop in 18-year-olds that's coming at us very fast, and lifelong learning as well, how we respond to an ageing population and support learning through life. We are looking at the juxtaposition of competition and collaboration. How can we support strong partnership working across the sector and break down some of those barriers? Financial sustainability, as I mentioned earlier, is absolutely crucial. We need to really take a good long look at how we can ensure that institutions can deliver high quality education and research on a more secure financial footing than we've seen across the UK, including Wales, in recent years. And perhaps the part that I'm most passionate about is how we can ensure that our institutions deliver for the economy of the future as well. I think it's so important that we align education with the needs of the evolving economy. And I do think that that actually will tie into financial sustainability as well.
And the call for evidence was accompanied by, you know, quite a sort of substantive policy paper setting out the nuts and bolts of the issues. I mean, one of the areas that caught our attention at Wonky was around student finance and this sort of observation that, you know, there's a pressure on the Welsh system that stems from the need to stay in step with Westminster Treasury set rules. And it says in the paper, you know, these will likely require that the Welsh government reviews and possibly amends some of its policies on both student support and on student loan repayments. I mean, you know, Wales has always been very proud about having a progressive student finance system, one that's more progressive than England's has become. I mean, are those days numbered?
Well, you know, you focus there on the values that have always underpinned our student finance system, the values that were brought in with the diamond reforms. And we really do intend to stick to those. It's finding a way of doing that that will remain within that financial envelope that's set for us by UK Treasury. And I think, you know, coming back to those five areas that we've identified in the paper that will help towards those goals. But there's no doubt about it that it is a challenge to remain within that financial envelope. Obviously, our student maintenance grants are ones that we fund ourselves outside of that. So it's really looking at, you know, how do we want to focus those for the future to ensure that we can retain these core values.
And another part of the call for evidence that really caught our attention was the section on competition and collaboration, which you sort of mentioned already. I mean, and the paper pointed out that, I mean, the word it uses at one point is there's been a sort of aggressive competition UK-wide for undergraduate recruitment in particular. And in some instances, this is, you know, becoming a risk to the viability of, you know, certain aspects of the Welsh system. I mean, you know, and it seems to us that sort of addressing this seriously, it could potentially mean some quite large changes to how the sector works, to how things like admissions work. I mean, is this the kind of sort of, you know, big thinking that you're interested in hearing about in the call for evidence?
It absolutely is. And, you know, there's no doubt about it that the complexity and the breadth of the ideas that we're floating are ones that I'm hoping will catch the eye of UK government as well, because some of these areas, as you pointed out, are not devolved. And I think we've got an opportunity here with a really strong evidence base to set a precedent for changes that could be implemented on a UK-wide basis. But having said that, there's still plenty of work that can be done within Wales as well. And I'm really proud of some of the collaborative efforts that have been undertaken within Wales. We've got the North Wales Tertiary Alliance, for example, that's bringing together both the FE colleges and universities there. We have other examples in South Wales as well, around the semiconductor areas. And all of that really helps, that level of collaboration helps to unlock research funding as well as cutting costs with back office issues as well. So there is plenty that we can do here within Wales, but I'm certainly wishing to cast the net wider and look at UK-wide issues as well.
Right. And if I could finish by asking a final question about research, which, as you just mentioned, it sort of forms part of one of the challenges you've picked out, one of the five challenges, this one around maximizing public investment, both in teaching and in research. I mean, for research, there's the context of budget constraints, but there's also, you know, the UK government and UK research and innovation wanting research to be more specialized, this sort of, you know, kind of playing to one's strengths agenda. You know, it sort of feels like, I mean, please correct me if I'm wrong here, but that, you know, there's a feeling in the policy paper that Welsh university research is going to need to change. Would that be fair?
I think that is fair to say, and it's something that Vice Chancellors and Universities Wales have been quite frank with me about as well, because our universities here were historically very reliant on EU structural funds to support their research activity. And so with the end of that EU funding, our institutions really must shift now towards securing more competitively awarded research income. So that's why we're asking in the call for evidence how we can support research funding and whether collaboration and specialisation of institutions can create efficiencies and those stronger agglomeration effects for teaching and employment and our D&I as well.
So that's about it for this week. Remember to go in deep on anything we've discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget to subscribe. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcast. And if you want to get ahead of everything going on in UKHE, just click subscriptions on the site to find out more. So thanks very much to Ben, Smita, Vicky Howes and Michael Saran for making it all happen. We'll be back next week. Mark will be here. Until then, stay wonky.